When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Crossover Sports Illustrated's NBA show, breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your hosts, Rohan Khabib and Chris Herring.
Welcome back to another episode of the Crossover Podcast. I'm Rohan Khabib, joined today by my good friend, New York Times best-selling author of the book, Blood in the Garden, Chris Herring. Chris, how's it going, buddy?
I'm good, Rohan. How are you? Happy Friday to you.
I'm chilling, brother. Listen, every now and then, I'm going to be honest, I love a good playoff blowout. You know, it just, it takes the edge off. It takes the edge off just a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, some of these nights, you're so locked in, the adrenaline's going, you can't sleep. I sleep peacefully after a blowout, brother.
I do too. It normally makes the analysis a little bit easier than having to, you know, go in with a fine tooth comb to, you know, or to have to be mad about it, one call that shifted the whole game.
Right.
And, you know, and the hot like takes the refs that are going to emanate from that.
Like the refs missing the ball blatantly hitting the rim. You talking about something like that?
Bruh, can I just say that I was at Heat Knicks game two and, you know, obviously they've been moving the media seats further and further from the court, but that happened, and the very second it happened with my naked eye, I was like, did that not hit the rim? And sitting next to me are like reporters that I trust and like, and, you know, take their word for it when they disagree with me and I'm tripping. But I was like, I could swear they hit the rim. And then when they showed replays and I watched it on the monitor, I'm like, that absolutely hit rim. And I mean, look, the final score would not dictate that, you know, like that was the difference, but also it was like was it a 5-point swing or 4-point swing right there in a game that was 8 points, and or was it even 8? I don't remember what the final score was. That game was close enough to where that felt like a big momentum shift, particularly because on a play like that, who was it, Gabe Vincent, that grabbed the rebound and put it back instantly, which would have counted. So I was more stunned that they didn't even review it, but I guess there wasn't anything that triggered a review. And that's something where I think the league could be better about that, is there was actually a dead ball because they called the 24-second violation. Why not just review it instead of moving on? Like, I don't know. That was very, very odd to me. Very odd to me. Anyway.
Listen, the fix was clearly in. Clearly the coastal elitists at the NBA put the fix in against the blue-collar, hardworking Miami Heat, and that's okay.
Miami's coastal too.
It's just another obstacle for the hardest working organization in professional sports to overcome. Chris, so much I want to get to on the show today. Excited to talk about some of these playoff games with you. Let's start with some playoff fallout. We're starting to get some playoff fallout now. I know this is something we discussed on the podcast before this news happened, but yesterday the Bucks announced the firing of Mike Budenholzer. You know, very tough. First and foremost, we just want to send our condolences to Bud, dealing with the loss in the family. It's so terrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously that transcends whatever this is, you know, on the job side of it, on the basketball side of it. The Bucks let him go. He obviously wins the championship with the team in 2021, but it felt like every other year in the playoffs, things were tenuous with Bud. You know, in 2020, they lose to the 5-seed Miami Heat. Last year, they have the Middleton injury, but they lose to Boston in 7 games. This year, losing the first round to Miami in 5 games, even with Giannis healthy for 2.25 of them. They lose the 2 games with Giannis healthy. They blow 2 huge leads. In the fourth quarter, a lot of Bud's decision-making there called into question, and I think rightfully so, down the stretch of those last couple games. Not double teaming Jimmy Butler, not changing the coverage on him, misuse of timeouts, etc. Unfortunate way for Budenholzer to go out, who really raised the floor of that team. Is there someone you'd like to see the Bucks go get? Because I think we all are kind of on the same page that this was an obvious move for them to make.
Let me start with this first. And I'm glad you said it from the standpoint of his brother. Because I felt bad. And it's not, I don't think it was because we did anything wrong necessarily, but after they were eliminated, we had on this podcast a conversation about what the next logical step for that organization was. Mm. And I think all of us pretty much agreed. I don't completely remember what you said, but I think all of us were relatively in agreement that like this was the most logical step to make.
I don't think any of us ever want to be on here and be like, they should fire this guy. But we also know the rhythms of this league and what what's available to organizations and what changes you can make. And yeah, so I think we're on the same page that if they were going to make a change, he was kind of the obvious, one.
So yeah, so we had that conversation, obviously without knowledge of what was happening in his personal life, which as we talk about different things, that stuff, it's very real stuff for people when you look at performance, when you look like. I kind of want to say more, but I guess I shouldn't theoretically do it. But like, there's always stuff going on with people, and these are people at the end of the day.
Sure.
And so, that stuff is always happening in the background that we don't know about. That when we're asking, wow, this seems really off, or this seems like this team's not doing well, stuff is fluid and stuff changes in people's lives where you're just not having a good day, you're not having a good year. Mm-hmm. It's not why this change is being made ultimately. There have been a lot of other shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
I also think he deserves a ton of credit for what you mentioned before, which was not raising the floor of the team, but like, I mean, literally like with a crane and with all this construction equipment, putting actual footing underneath this team, but at a much higher level, which I guess all it means is raising the floor, but raising the floor to an extreme. Because they essentially, for the better part of his tenure, were a close to 60 win team every year, and came in and instantly, when we complained about how the Bucks seemed like they had all this talent, and then all of a sudden, Giannis is playing in an offense that has a ton of space. We're watching Brook Lopez bomb threes, and even from that point, this team still changed a lot. The year they won the championship, I remember writing. Our title game story and kind of like their season arc story. That was a team that had been really bad at rebounding, quite frankly, and made a point to send their corner shooters in to crash the boards. Mm-hmm. And it made a big difference in that final series. I remember Pat Connaughton talked my ear off about that. Brook Lopez talked my ear off about that. It was also a team that put in like an offense that really kind of didn't work right away. With the dunker spot and trying to put someone in the dunker spot to try to make better use of the spacing and try to put Giannis somewhere else. So he was, the team suffered offensively stat-wise early in the season, but they won a title in part because of it later in the season. So he deserves a lot of credit for tinkering with some things around the edges. I was reading takes even from some bloggers that I respect in Milwaukee where they're just like, can you really point to anything he's done that has been an improvement beyond when he first got here? And it's like, I can. Like, they won a title in part because of some of that stuff. I also think Giannis improved a lot just because the situation that Bud put in place for them.
Right. It was obvious, some would say it was obvious, but using Giannis as a screener, Bud started doing that. This year, they changed their defensive coverage. They were a team that used to give up a ton of threes. Grant Williams lit him up in game 7. Brook Lopez talked my ear off about that. He said, yeah, we came in training camp. We changed our scheme, changed who the most important guy was. Bud hammered that in. They gave up way less threes this year. And then they ran into a super hot Heat team that shot way better than anyone could have ever predicted. So, yeah, it's tough.
This is how I always hope to have these conversations, frankly. It's like there's good and there's bad. You can't win a championship without there being good. He's a fantastic coach. Because I think for all the for all the criticisms, and rightfully so. I'm not saying that there's nothing to criticize him for. There is. And I think we could also be honest in saying this would have happened the year that they won the title had they not won the title.
Right.
So, like, there's plenty of criticism to go around. I'm trying to balance that a little bit by saying, like, just like with anything, relationships, people, jobs,
multitudes.
You know, in this case, his job.
Yeah.
There's multitudes to it. And I don't like the idea, particularly as we learn that, oh, his brother also passed away. Like, I don't like the fact that it's just like everything he did wrong. And I think even in the way the statement was crafted by the Bucks, and I've gotten to know some of the people in the Bucks front office, like, I don't think that this is, they didn't want to do this. It's just, I just think it's logically what probably needed to happen because changes need to be made. And frankly, now they have new ownership as well. And so, you know, like, there's going to be more pressure to change something to try to take the next step forward. But Bud did, it's way harder than anybody gives credit to to change, to lift the floor of a team by basically blowing everything up and having the courage to do that when you've got a potential superstar in his prime, entering his prime, to just say, like, we're going to do all this stuff totally differently. There were a lot of things that he didn't do as well that I never understood. I've talked before about the idea that he would sub Giannis in and out for 30 seconds, 1 minute at a time at the end of close games, particularly in that Toronto series that they ended up losing that was pretty brutal where they'd taken a 2-0 lead in the conference final. So there were things, there are plenty of things, but I would imagine he should get a call very quickly to get a job elsewhere, and I'm looking forward to that because I, like, we talk about revenge bodies when people have breakups. He should have a revenge tour of like, he can do this with another organization. Another organization would be stupid not to give him an opportunity because I see people saying, oh, well, anybody could have done this with Giannis, then why weren't they? And maybe they will, you know, maybe it'll just be a continuation, whoever coaches the team next. I'm not sure who's the best person. Like, I'll be honest in saying that with the exception of Kevin Arnovitz always did those assistant coach profiles and stuff and, like, the up-and-coming coaches. Aside from him, like, there aren't that many people providing windows into who the good assistants next are. And even then, like, there are probably some really good ones that we just don't know of. So if that's the route the Bucks are going to take, I'm not sure. I saw Steve Nash on a short list on, like, from an odd standpoint. I was like, yeah, if you're letting go of Bud to do that, then you're on Bud.
We have Steve Nash at home, aka we did Jason Kidd already.
We're gonna move right along.
I will say that I would be interested in giving Frank Vogel a look there. I think he's a little bit underrated as a coach. Was a scapegoat a little bit for what happened with the Lakers.
He's due to have another job. Yeah, but that would be a beautiful job for him to walk into, and it's he's a defense-minded guy who's coached teams that kind of have bigs and like ball handling forwards, Pacers and then obviously the Lakers. Yeah. Nick Nurse is that what a name you're going to mention?
Yeah, also both are interesting. Both are interesting for different reasons. I will say one addendum to this conversation, then we can move on to the playoff stuff. I'm not saying Giannis needs to be selfish. The beauty of Giannis is that he is who he is. And he's, like, polite is probably the best way to describe him.
I'll say it if you don't want to.
Something that's interesting to me is, like, one of the stories that's come out is Spo telling the story of Jimmy Butler when he hit the game-tying shot in Game 5 to send it into overtime. And Spo was drawing up a play, and Jimmy said, no, let it be me. Let it be me. You know, Jrue Holiday is going to defend me this way. He's going to trail me. I'm going to get an open look. Give me the ball. I'm sure Giannis does that at times. But when Giannis is asked after that game, you know, did you want to guard Jimmy Butler? He's like, yes. You know, maybe Drew's tired, but I don't want to go over my coach, etc. Listen, that's great. That's a great quality for Giannis. At the same time, like, it's not like when Jimmy Butler does that to Eric Spoelstra, he's you know, undermining his authority. It's a collaborative process. He says, coach, this is what I've seen. Like, whoever the Bucks next coach is, again, Giannis is unimpeachable. He's a champion. Everything about him, I think, is great. I'm not saying he needs to be more selfish, but I don't think he should be afraid.
I'm saying it for you. If you won't say it, this is the second time I'll say that. Yeah. He could be, and it's the second or third time in a postseason that he said this. Right. In terms of the minutes he plays, in terms of who he's guarding, I think this is the second time, maybe the second straight postseason, he's said that from the standpoint of, yeah, I wanted to, like, of course you want to, but I'm going to do what my coach asked me to do.
Right.
And basically what you're saying, in so many words, is that the history of the league dictates that superstars can make those calls. That you, just like with anything else, like that you trust, you're going to live and die with your best player's shot selection, with the shot that they can get at the end of the game, even if they're being guarded by the best player. You aren't going to lose a job over putting the ball in the best player's hands. That's not going to ever be why. Now, if you don't give your all-world, probably like best all-around player in the league, like offense, defense, you're not going to be criticized for doing that. What you will be criticized for is if you don't put that person in position, at least see what they can do.
Right.
And that was a big that was a big difference. Again, going back to the Raptors series that they lost when they were up 2-0, is that that series shifted when Kawhi said, I'm going to take Giannis.
Yeah.
In addition to being the guy on the other end of the floor. And it was a massive difference. Now, at that point in Giannis's career, before they had won, I think you can at least, you can at least kind of say maybe Giannis needs to take the reins there. But if he's not going to and he's not going to step up and say, I want to do those things, I don't want to guard Kawhi, then as his coach, you have to ask him, like, can you do this for us? I think you should do this for us. And so I will say that just from that standpoint, some of the other things we've talked about, there's going to be a clear opportunity for someone to just do stuff differently than Mike Budenholzer did. In the same way that there was an opportunity for Budenholzer to do things much differently than Jason Kidd did.
Right.
Not only with their offense, which was obvious, but defensively, they did this stuff with jump switches and all these other things that were just kind of, their defense was chaotic in a way that was more chaotic for them than it was for offenses playing against them. So, I mean, there's progression. Mike Budenholzer has put them in such a good position, even if they've fallen short in years where they should not have. This is a massive opportunity for anybody to step in and win a championship. And because this move has now been made, there's probably a little bit less stress and pressure on the roster itself. It's a roster that is ready to win a title. You know, and also, you know, God willing, Giannis is healthy next time as opposed to missing a couple games, which swings a series or can swing a series at least, and did in this case, helped swing the series at least. So so we'll see. But it's fascinating to think about that job being open. It really is.
Heat in five, no matter what. Let's move on to the actual games here. Let's talk a little bit about what we saw last night. Lakers-Warriors game two. The Warriors come away with a 27-point victory, 127 to 100. Anthony Davis, after his 30 and 23 outburst in game one, held to 11 points, 7 rebounds in game two. The Warriors shoot 50% from three. I think they were 21-42 exactly, maybe 21-43. I don't know, something crazy. This was a drubbing. I think a lot of us expected the Warriors to come out with the great energy. You know, LeBron looked a little bit better. At least his efficiency was up, although he still has not had a... This is... For people who wanted, like, the 2015 to 2018 LeBron hunting Steph Curry every time down the floor, we haven't seen that. I thought the story last night was Draymond Green. I wrote about him on a story you should be seeing on SI.com by the time you listen to this. But we always talk about what Steph does that makes the Warriors possible, right? Like, because of Steph, you can get away playing Draymond and Looney together. Because of Steph, you can do XYZ. They have such a symbiotic relationship because Draymond's existence allows them to do something like start Jermichael Green, and you're not losing. If anything, you're gaining something defensively. Like, they played better defensively because they put Jermichael Green in the game and decided we're putting Draymond on Anthony Davis. And how many teams, I can't think of another team in the league that says, we're going to put our 6'6 guy on Anthony Davis and it's going to make us better defensively. And that's only possible because of Draymond. And then on the other end of the floor, they're able to play spaced out offense because they're not worried about losing something defensively. Most teams, when they go small, are going to lose something on that end of the floor. And I just thought he had such a brilliant two-way game last night. What'd you think of game two, Chris?
Man, there's so much to it. You know, as we talked about, you normally don't have to go through it with a fine-tooth comb necessarily to make the points you want to make or kind of the pieces of analysis that you're going to pull. I mean, but you hit on a few of them. Steph and not needing to control the game with the scoring. Honestly, and we'll get to this as we talk about the Heat-Knicks series too, I think a few of these teams were almost too aggressive defensively because it's like if you push something too far in one direction, then something else happens as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So Steph, after the way he's been playing lately, you don't want him to beat you. So it's basically like, all right, we're going to run two guys at him. And in so many of the sequences, they were doing that, but not doing it like aggressively enough. And so it's like a relatively simple pass for Steph to make, which the very first basket of the game, we see, you know, a pass to Jermichael Green, and then Jermichael Green hits Draymond for an easy layup. It was kind of the story of the game to me, at least from an offensive standpoint. There was that. So Steph had 12 assists and Draymond had 9. And it was like, okay, so that's not typically how it looks. Steph rarely has that many assists in a game because he's normally asked to score more, but... If you're making him pass the ball, he's going to do it, but you can't. You have to collapse on him better and kind of with more of an element of surprise than the way they were doing it. So I understood the point behind it, but it kind of got all their guys into a rhythm. By the way, that sort of tic-tac-toe level passing also has the ability to hurt you more deeply when Jermichael Green's in the lineup and he's hitting threes, which he was. So that's different than Kevon Looney being there because Kevon Looney's not going to torch you from three. So there was that stood out right away because it's like, well, that's their whole defensive strategy.
Have you seen Kevon Looney's UCLA highlights?
I can be honest in saying that I'm not a big draft person.
So nor am I, because I feel like
we have to lock in so heavily to NBA.
Someone tweeted after like his 20 offensive rebound game. It was like Kevon Looney's UCLA bag or something like that. And he was like 41% from three his last year. Bro, he's going between the legs, step back, J, pull up three. I was like, what in the world is going on? It was just funny to hear
between
you talk
that
about,
and
yeah, Looney's threes because I've seen him do it.
But these guys,
apparently.
I mean, like, as someone who, you know, watches these guys warm up before games, watches them in practice and in shoot around, watches them have, you know, watches these players have shooting contests and stuff like that, you know, have heard all the time about Shaq and Dwight Howard and these guys. Watch Dwight Howard have like a 40-point triple double in his first game in China or whatever. Like, these guys can all shoot. They all have a ton of talent. They're also very skilled. Montrezl Harrell is the same way. Like, these guys can all really shoot.
For sure.
It's just not game ready normally. And it's like also at that level, know your role kind of.
Right.
And Kevon
Looney definitely.
Literally
star
might
in his
be better
role.
In his
star
role.
In his role.
Than right. anybody else in the league. So I think that's more what that is than anything else. But
for sure.
That actually
funny.
Wouldn't totally stun me. But
right.
He's not in an NBA game, he's probably not going to torture
definitely
you the
not.
Way
definitely not.
Jermichael Green can. Yeah. And even Jermichael Green has not been great. He's not played all that much this season, but this was like a good time to roll him out. And I think even to the point where a lot of people weren't assumed that this was more of a tactic on Steve Kerr's part as opposed to Kevon Looney being sick. It could have been a little bit of both, but it worked really well and was a good way when you talk about what were the takeaways. This forces Anthony Davis to play defense differently because of the fact that Kevon Looney can shoot. Or I'm sorry, now you have me on that.
Jermichael Green can shoot.
Obviously, Jermichael Green can shoot. The perception of his shooting is better and more dangerous and more lethal than Kevon Looney doing it. And so he had to play it differently. So he had to step up more. And it was part of the reason that you were seeing between that and Steph and the tic-tac-toe passing, you were watching Anthony Davis come up higher, which does all sorts of things. Austin Reeves looked bad yesterday defensively, not because he wasn't putting in effort, but because he just was getting snared in every screen. that they set on him. And so Clay got went nuts because of it. And it took a toll. It looks like it's taking a toll on Austin Reeves' ability to play offense because he's so worn down. And that was one of the things to look for in the series. So there were a lot of things, but I'll mention this last one, and then I feel like I've taken all the talking points from
you're good. You're good.
The Lakers, too, like, we'll probably talk about it if we talk at Denver-Phoenix. You've written about kind of where Phoenix's shortcomings are offensively in that series. The Lakers breakdown, you talked about the 21 threes that the Warriors hit. The Lakers are taking too many shots from mid-range yesterday, and it's like the math is not going to work between Anthony Davis potentially having to score against Draymond and the fact that they weren't taking that many threes. LeBron, in some cases, looks like he's settling for a lot of twos, probably because of his foot, but a lot of long twos. It's like that's not a sustainable winning strategy. Even if you get hot from mid-range one game, it's going to be hard to beat a team that's hitting 21 threes when it's the Warriors, too. You know they're capable of doing that more than once in a series.
I mean, I couldn't believe the Lakers lost, were minus 45 from the three-point line in game one and still won. I mean, part of it is it's like they were able to get to the line. AD went nuts.
Yes.
What do you make of... So AD has kind of... This has been his postseason. It's like one great scoring game, one less great scoring game. And the defense has generally been great. But clearly they're at their best, I think, when he's, you know, also dominating offensively. Especially when you think of where LeBron kind of is at this point in his career with both the age and the foot injury. I mean, he's just not ISO LeBron anymore. He's not grind your possessions down to as slow as possible, get the switch he wants. Like, we have not seen that LeBron so far in the playoffs. And if you look at the box score, the box score looks okay, but it's not LeBron James. What's your confidence level in AD right now?
I mean, let's be real here. There were a couple stats that jumped out yesterday. One was Steph and how many more pick and rolls they ran, even in less minutes. I think he played 8 less minutes and had 2 more pick and rolls that he ran. And this, keep in mind, this is not a pick and roll heavy team. The other massive question here is like, okay, LeBron has taken a step back. It looks, I won't say intentional, but it looks like that, you know, it's like not something that the Lakers are surprised by. It's part of what they're expecting. You can do that when AD is playing the way he did in game one. You can't, like, LeBron's not playing an ISO heavy enough game to carry you at this point. Mm-hmm. And frankly, even the plays where it looked like he was kind of ISOing or kind of doing it on his own, he was backing guys into the post for 5 and 6 seconds at a time. The Warriors look kind of content to let him do that, where they're basically like, okay, make this tough fade away, this tough turnaround in the lane from 15 feet. Between that and Anthony Davis having to figure out how to score on Draymond Green, good luck. Also, it's also not going to work if Jermichael Green is outscoring AD, which is what happened. Between that and then Kevon Looney, I think, having the most rebounds of anyone despite 12, only playing 12 minutes. 12
minutes, yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of warning signs there. The Warriors played desperately as they needed to, because keep in mind, yes, they fell behind 2-0 the last series. The difference between those situations, though, is
huge,
the fact that
they're at home
the Kings had their first two games at home. The Lakers would have been going home. And also the Lakers have more experience and have a couple guys, key guys on their team that have won a title there. So it would have been different. The Warriors seem to play with that urgency. They seem to really come out with a lot of strategic changes. The Lakers are probably going to have to roll out with some too, because that didn't necessarily feel like a fluke. Oh, they just got hot. No, this was a game where it was like, okay, they're doing stuff specifically to kind of eat away at some of the Lakers' advantages. Anthony Davis's length. Okay, make him step out further. If we make him step out further and they're pressuring Steph with the ball, make quick passes, swing the ball quickly, and it doesn't give people time to recover. Wear the hell out of Austin Reeves. Make him a non-factor in this series because we're making him defend so hard. Tough scene, basically, for the Lakers. Like, if the Warriors are going to do this, it doesn't mean that they don't have a chance, but it means that they're going to have to be on fire and they're going to have to be efficient and that they're going to have to get really good performances out of AD and LeBron, which good luck doing that when Draymond Green is guarding Anthony Davis as opposed to Kevon Looney. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. I'm also very intrigued now to see if, like, when Draymond got suspended and then they played better and won that game, they left the lineup the way it was when Draymond was out with Poole. I'd be interested to see now whether they start JaMychal Green again, just in light of the way Kerr handled it the last time. Like, it would make a lot of sense. Why wouldn't you? This was a great
game. It makes a lot of sense to split up Draymond and Looney, especially in this series with AD. You want him out of the paint as much as possible. So I pulled up LeBron's playoff
stats. And can I say
this
one thing?
Go ahead, please.
The one thing I'll say, and I'll let you go because I feel like I've been talking too much. There's a difference between switching Looney or Draymond out for Poole versus bringing in JaMychal Green, because he's still a big. Mm-hmm. He's just a stretch big or more of a floor spacing big. He can defend well enough. He's not going to hurt you in the way that Jordan Poole does. He's also not. I mean, Jordan Poole is a whole different level of hit or miss.
He's not. Kamikaze drives to the hoop.
So it's a completely different level of like, if he wants to go with that switch for a second game in a row, I would understand. And I'm curious to see how.
Basically,
it plays.
JaMychal Green's not showing off for the baddies sitting courtside is what you're trying to say.
Oh my god! All right, what point were you gonna make about LeBron's stats? I can't with you.
So I pulled up LeBron's playoff stats. He's currently averaging the lowest points per game of his playoff career, tied for the fewest assists, lowest three-point percentage, second fewest free throw attempts, second only to last year when they only played, or 2 years ago when they only played six games. Like, these are bad numbers. These are bad numbers. But it also had me looking at his 2018 postseason line when he was 34-9-9 for 22 games on that hilariously bad Cavs team and shot 56% from the field. Oh my god, that was an absolutely insane. 54% from the field. That was an absolutely insane LeBron run. Good lord. Those last two Cavs years, unbelievable. But yeah,
I'm hopeful this is just his foot, by the way, because, like,
I think it's,
you know,
the foot.
I know that it's something that,
yeah,
I do too, but I'm hopeful that it is, because I don't know what at some point the drop off will happen, whether it's injury related or not. And I just hope it's not like precipitous to where it's like we don't even really see Bron ISOs anymore. Like, him being an off the ball player has been weird to watch.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's disconcerting.
It's probably the way it should happen, given that Anthony Davis is on his team. He's younger. If he can stay healthy, he's the guy you would trust to do that. But it's disconcerting, and it is because it kind of felt like it was all at once, which does lead me to think that it's injury based and not just like, oh, he's 38. But then again, Chris Paul looked really old all of a sudden in the playoffs last year. So, who knows? In the finals last year, of all places, but I trust that it's more injury related because it's been so abrupt. But they're gonna need a really, really great game or two or three from him to win this series more than just game one. And Davis, that obviously goes, you know, is true of from a defensive standpoint, has to be integral for them and has to do more offensively, even if Draymond's guarding him. Like, that's the role of a superstar, the same way that we saw Jokic do it. I hate to be Shaq, but it's like, you know, he's got to go out and get 35.
35 and 12.
The funniest thing about James Harden is that he actually did that in game one. And it was like Shaq literally had no critiques because laid out pregame what he wanted to see from. He's like, well, I can't say anything. It's the only time I've ever seen that happen. That was hilarious.
He was like, I love it. He's so, he's like, I would have put up 43 and 20, Ernie. He's like
that's his answer to everything, man.
Yeah. But then after Jokic's game two also, he's like, can't say anything. Big fella was dominant. It's just like, Jokic had 37 and 14 or something. It's just so funny because Shaq, doesn't care how these people are getting their numbers. Like, DeAndre Ayton, if Ayton had 22 points, Shaq would be dominant game from the, not ignoring the fact that Ayton is shooting entirely mid-range pocket pass jumpers. He's dominant game from big fella.
Oh, man.
Oh, it's I love it. Yeah. I wouldn't change a thing about that show.
He is the most consistent with his analysis of anyone I know. I would say him and Tim Legler in very different ways.
Yes. Shaq's like, just like
Tim Legler is very consistent. Shaq is too, but it's always like
it's so funny
box score based and like.
But Shaq is also like, yeah, I would have dominated. Why won't you? I don't get it. Like, you know what I mean?
Very much so. But this is generally the critique that people lay out of like why superstars don't make good coaches is because they would have that train of thought. There have been a few that have been fine. Yeah. I think Larry Bird is one of the better ones we've seen. But yeah, it's part of what makes it so funny, in my opinion.
God, I love Inside the NBA. Let's move on.
I do too.
Let's move on to the Chris Tucker. Oh my God, the Chris Tucker cameo was so good, dude. That was so good.
Yo, I tweeted about it like three times because I could not believe it was happening. Like, teenage me was so excited. And it was so random that, I mean, they have made such a joke out of the Kenny Smith
thing. Imagine if someone, my favorite part about Inside the NBA is like, so obviously we've been watching for however many years, right? So we remember when Kenny first started running. Then you remember when Shaq and Chuck first started running. Now you know about like all the, like, imagine if someone was watching the show for the first time that night. And they're like, what is happening? Like, why? Like, they would have no clue
why
what's
do they
going
do
on.
These things that nobody else does. It is one inside joke that's been running for like 17 years.
Yes,
like the show as a whole is that.
Yes,
between the Shaqt and a Fool, between the stat of the night that they're going to show from Ernie Johnson that never has no sponsors,
unsullied by sponsorship,
pokes fun at the fact that there aren't. The fact that they now drop like props and things from the ceiling onto Shaq and, you know, rubber ducks and everything else. Like, it's just the fact that they can't tell, you know, Charles Barkley can't say the word balls without Shaq cracking up, like, and just like completely derailing whatever conversation they're having. Like, it's the show. There are so many level-headed critiques that I've raised, that everybody has raised about, you know, the jokes that they make about, you know, not being able to pronounce Giannis's last name and like who he play for, and the fact that like these guys are paid very handsomely and don't even know which teams a lot of these guys play for now when they move teams. Like, that, all those things are completely fair to critique. I have beat the drum hard about those things, and then we should keep doing it. Like, but let's not lie and say that the show's not entertaining. Like,
no,
I think both things can
honestly
be true at once, because it's so funny most of the time.
And there's times where they still have the best analysis of the national broadcast, but we don't need to get into all that. I'll also bring up the Chris Tucker thing just to say that
you're
about
to get some emails over that statement.
That I texted you the Denzel clip. And it's like Shaq, it's interviewing Denzel years ago. And
Shaq's like, yes. I was trying to remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
And then Shaq's like, Denzel, like, hit me with that King Kong line. And Denzel Washington, who's such a huge Lakers fan, loves Shaq so much. Like, you know, I'm sure people are asking Denzel to do the training day speech all the time and he's sick of it. But for Shaq, he's like, I'm going
to
personalize it for you.
To be.
But like, he's so excited to do
imagine.
It for Shaq.
Oh, can I say this, that as between that and like, so the Chris Tucker, for people who didn't see it, Chris Tucker was randomly appeared on Inside the NBA last
halftime
week.
Show. Yeah, the halftime show.
During the halftime show. And what we're talking about, Kenny Smith, when he wants to go almost like to the telestrator that they have sitting behind them, and he like runs back there to, I think he probably does it because he's knock-kneed and he's had surgeries and it like looks less awkward if he jogs as opposed to walking, whatever. He does that, and sometimes Shaq or Charles Barkley will randomly race him back there and he won't notice that
someone is
trying to challenge him back there until midstream. And in this case, Chris Tucker came out of nowhere and raced back there. And it was like, where the hell did Chris Tucker, who like up until a few years ago was like not even a focal point of society anymore. Like, he had just literally vanished, and he just runs up on the stage. But just how big these guys are in terms of their fandom for him, for all the movies he's done, from Friday to Rush Hour to Money Talks to everything. He's just so funny. And so of course they make him do like the Michael Jackson dance.
Yeah.
Because he was in a Michael Jackson video.
And the thing is, all the people that get on the show love Shaq, Kenny, and Chuck so much, and Ernie, that they're willing to do whatever for them. Like, I think people ask for Sucker to Dance.
And I can only imagine how annoying it has to be.
Right.
I don't think he minded that because, like you said, he's a fan, just like Denzel's a fan. And trust me, just to tell you how much of a fan that these guys have, these celebrities have to be of these four guys, having hung out with Spike Lee even once or twice for the book and the doc collaboration that we have going on, I was courtside with him. He gets asked repeatedly by complete strangers about what his movies mean, which of his movies was his favorite to make. And these are strangers, and it's like I imagine you have to have a pretty canned response to these things, let alone the selfies that people request left and right. Like, I'm sitting courtside with him at the Knicks game, and I can't even, like, have a conversation with him because it's so consistently interrupted mid-game while there's a game happening 3 feet away from us. So it's like it wears on these guys. Like, that was the first thing I noticed right away with Spike, is that the degree to which you do not get a chance to just sit and enjoy anything. A dinner, a game. I mean, I'm sure you still enjoy it, but it's like you're doing it with interruptions left and right. Mm-hmm. When other celebrities, particularly ones you really respect and really enjoy and have brought joy to you, ask, I imagine that they're happy to do it because it's like they probably, even if they're asking them to do that, they understand what it is to have people hound them all the time.
Right.
You know, Chuck seems like he's great about that, where he had that really heartwarming story about
the man in Alabama whose funeral he went to? Charles Barkley and Shaq have all kinds of crazy stories.
They do. I believe it was like a cat litter scientist, if I'm remembering correctly. Like, that was kind of what he did for a living. And it was one of the most beautiful stories I've heard in years, just about a celebrity relating with someone that could not be further from celebrity. But I think that sometimes, every now and then, as much as these guys do get annoyed by the cheerleaders and the fanboys and everything like that, you also get people that just respect what they do and know how to keep it pushing. And in that case, it sounded like that's what that was. And they just had a conversation that just lasted for hours. And I think they like connecting with normal people in a natural way, not in a way that feels forced. But anyway, how we got to all that,
I don't know.
It's probably my fault. But
it's all good. I could talk about it inside the NBA for hours. For sure. Let's talk about it. Was far enough in the pod. Daryl Swenson probably stopped listening by now. Shout out to Daryl.
Daryl was the one I was thinking about when I'm like, I don't know how this just happened.
Let's talk about Heat Knicks a little bit before we get out of here. We talked about this in our group chat. That was not a very impressive showing from the Knicks in game two. I thought they had a lot of success against Miami's zone, but the Heat played a lot of zone because Jimmy Butler was gone. Julius Randle was fine. He's working his way back from injury. Respect to him from going out there. It's not like he put his stamp on that game in such a way that you were like, oh, the Knicks got Randle back. You know, Brunson again kind of took over in the fourth quarter. We joked about it at the top of the pod. There were
I'd say that. I might disagree with that a little bit.
With what?
What was Randle 6-for-10 from three?
I don't think he hit that many threes. I'm going to have to look it up. I think
maybe I'm mixing it up with something else.
I'm saying Randle was good, but not so good
Randle
that you were like.
I thought Randle was pretty great.
That he was 8-for-18, sure. 3-for-9 from three.
They didn't put the game away.
Yes. I'm saying it was like, it wasn't like Giannis coming back and putting up 38-20. You know what I mean? Like, it's unfair to compare Randle to Giannis. My point was, it's not like he blew the game open or he, you know, it didn't feel like he changed the tenor of the series with his return, is what I'm saying. He was very good. He was very good, but he didn't feel like he, you know, again, like I'm saying, like Brunson was the guy in the fourth quarter. And then obviously there's a couple. I'm not even going to say they're bad calls. Like they're tough calls to make in the moment on replay, whatever. The Hartenstein foul, the shot clock violation, those ended up being kind of important moments in the game. In the fourth, so is the Heat's inability to get a rebound. Again, playing zone because of the lack of Jimmy. So what do you think, where are you leaning on this series moving forward?
I mean, first off, I think the Heat getting Butler back, I mean, will kind of nullify anything. If he's back and he looks anywhere near himself, mm-hmm. will nullify what we thought about game two. It was not an impressive win from the Knicks. It was just, you know, I mean, I saw people I follow saying, yo, almost like if you have an argument with your significant other and you guys disagree about something, like, let's not argue in front of, I mean, even what Chris Rock said about the Will Smith thing. He's like, yo, where I come from, like, we I was always taught we don't argue in front of white people. We're like, don't let white people see us arguing. Let's just get out of here and get this win and then complain about how it looked later. Let's complain about a win as opposed to a loss. And for a while, this game, like, as we talked about with the Warriors and how badly they needed game two because they were about to go on the road for 3-4 against a team that's won a championship. The Knicks were going to be in real trouble if not only are they down 0-2, Butler would be coming back potentially in game three with some rest, and you'd be going to Miami, which I don't necessarily think is like the most haunted place of all time from, you know, in terms of how loud the fans are going to get or anything like that.
Wow.
But I think
that says the Heat didn't seem bothered by the vaunted Madison Square Garden mystique either.
It's a lot easier to not be haunted by it when you've got Jimmy Butler. One, two.
Whoa, they didn't have Jimmy Butler in game two, and Gabe Vincent was cooking.
But the Heat were doing they're grinding the game down to a halt with the zone. They are bombing threes. Gabe Vincent is playing he's shooting like Duncan Robinson with defense. You know, Duncan Robinson from a couple years ago. With defense.
I'm sorry. The media loves to sprinkle a lot of Madison Square Garden masala everywhere during the playoffs. It's like, oh, the Knicks fans, the Knicks fans, the Knicks crowd. Oh, Chris Herring is sitting courtside. How are these players ever going to be able to focus? MSG's a different animal, blah, blah, blah. And then all I see is Gabe Vincent going in there, lighting these dudes up, and the Heat probably winning this game if Scott Foster can see what everyone else sees, which is that the ball hit the rim. So I'm from South Florida. I know
I'm not in disagreement from that standpoint.
I always hear about the Heat crowds, and I always hear about Madison Square Garden. It's a temple. You must go there. Blah, blah, blah. The Heat looked completely unfazed by the road environment without their best player.
As they should relative to a Cavs team that hasn't been to the playoffs before.
Right, yeah.
The Heat have been one game from the finals, mm-hmm. in the finals, a one seed all within the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. So I expect that of them even without Butler, but also what they're doing is trying to basically patch this together as best they can, mm-hmm. by bombing a mm-hmm. bunch of threes and running pick and rolls every play without Butler there. They don't really have much choice. You can win games that way. And mm-hmm. I think because the Knicks were just okay, they came away with a chance to win the game. By the way, I made that botch earlier. I was mentioning Randall's numbers and him being 6 of 10. That was Brunson. I don't know how I mixed this two up. Randall was 25-12-8 in a return game,
which
where,
is obviously
quite
very
frankly,
good.
Having
yes.
been there, watching him warm up, I didn't think he was going to play before the game. Me, Ian Begley, who covers the team for SNY, Fred Katz for The Athletic, we all kind of thought he wasn't necessarily going to play because he wasn't running before the game. He was just shooting. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, he's just trying to keep his shot, you know, in line and fresh and everything like that. He's not putting pressure on his leg, really. He's not really trying to test it the way that Brunson was before the game, the way that Grimes had done when he was trying to come back from his injury. So I was stunned that he even played and then played like that. He was making the right play and the right reads, which I think more so than how he shoots is more important because mm-hmm. when he, like, I think the Heat came at him the way that the Lakers were guarding Steph, not necessarily as far out, but I just think they were doubling early on Randall. I think maybe to test him out physically a little bit, But also, when the Knicks really tend to struggle is when Randle doesn't get rid of the ball or tries to force something.
Right.
He was making good reads. He was making skip passes. He was kicking the ball out at the appropriate time. And I think just like we saw with the Warriors yesterday, it got RJ Barrett into a really nice rhythm, which he's been great lately for the, especially in first halves. He's been great offensively for them. He's been keeping them afloat without Randle, with Brunson struggling at times. You know, we saw Josh Hart get a couple of open looks. Like, what I would say about the Knicks is that, what I would say about the Heat is that I understand that they're trying to compensate without Butler. I was surprised they stuck in zone for so long. They were basically in zone for the last three quarters of the game,
right,
which this is already the team that uses zone more than any other team has in the last 20 years, statistically. And so for them to have one of the games where they've used zone for the most that I can remember, just like at a certain point, teams require a different strategy, a different tact is required to try to keep a team off balance. And I kind of felt like at a certain point, Josh Hart got three or four looks from the exact same spot on the floor.
They figured it out. They figured it out by the end of the game.
They figured it out. And also, I'm not like the Heat run a lot of zones. So it's not like, you know, a lot of teams like the Kings, for instance, the Kings use zone. Mike Brown didn't like using zone, even though their defense wasn't particularly good when they were in man. He didn't like going to zone too often because he's like, I always worry from the standpoint of offensive rebounding being bad or like just killing us if we do that. And lo and behold, Kevon Looney has a 22 rebound game and, you know, 10, 11 of them, however many of them were offensive rebounds. So Mike Brown was spot on with that. The Heat normally don't have that problem, but they got killed at a certain point late in the game where Hartenstein was just really killing them and two and three and four shots on one possession, which then when you do get a three out of something like that, it just feels backbreaking. And so this was a winnable game for the Heat. They should, I mean, either way it went, if they came out of there with a split, they were golden. If they had gone up 2-0, you've got the Knicks on the ropes now. And so, I mean, they should feel good about that. They should feel extremely confident being at home. They should feel extremely confident if Butler can go, which I don't think it's a given that he can. But just knowing Jimmy Butler, I would imagine that he will try.
I would be very surprised if he... He got in an intense workout last night. I'm assuming he'll do the same today. And I can't imagine the team would be thrilled about him doing that if he wasn't going to go.
I agree.
The zone is interesting because a lot of times when Miami runs it, they're giving up open threes. And I think sometimes like teams are not used to the three-point looks they get from a zone, so they're not as confident shooting. Whereas the Knicks figured it out, got those threes, hit those shots, and that changed the tenor of the game. One thing I'm very interested to see is how Miami closes game three if theoretically – Butler and Randle are both playing and both healthy, because they closed game one with Jimmy, Bam, Vincent, Martin, and Lowry. So Jimmy's basically playing the power forward. And I wonder if they go to that versus Randle down the stretch and still play man, because I think Jimmy has actually had success against Julius Randle. It's not a matchup I think you want to play for a full game, but I think it's something that Jimmy could do for closing stretches. I'm just interested because that was a good lineup for the Heat that closed the both halves in game one. And it's a good lineup. You know, I've been talking to people about how the Heat have some advantages in terms of lineup building with Tyler Hero out, because Vincent, they're not sacrificing defense right now. Martin, they're not sacrificing defense. And it's I'm very interested to see what both teams close with, because in game one, it felt like if Randle's healthy, RJ Barrett's probably not on the floor in the end of game one. That's something
RJ Barrett wasn't on the floor at the end of And it's really interesting because Barrett has been the only guy that's been consistently scoring for them. And I mean, if you know anything about Barrett, the way we've talked about him, the knock on him is that he goes so hot and so cold. He starts every season horrible shooting it. He ended this season horribly, but he had a good stretch in the middle of the season where he was shooting 40-some percent from three. He's been lights out, really, shooting the ball since the middle of that Cavs series. He had a rough start to that series. He's been good, But also, he's not the best defender all the time. And the Knicks all of a sudden have a bevy of pretty good defenders between Josh Hart, Quentin Grimes. Quickly is a good defender for them. What's interesting now is that they've got so many choices, and it's kind of like, well, who are you leaning on more heavily? The people that you felt like you could trust in the regular season, which would be Quickly, but hasn't played well at all in the postseason, really, and has really mm-hmm. not been a difference maker. Do you play Hart, who I think is probably like a Thibodeau favorite because of all the different things he brings? He's an offensive rebounder despite standing 6'6". He's enough of a good defender. He did very, very well on Donovan Mitchell in the last series mm-hmm. When he got that assignment, and also got more opportunity to play because Quentin Grimes was hurt and kept you afloat during that. Do you go with Quentin Grimes, who is probably the best like balance between all those, not all those players. I think Quickly is great.
If on both Grimes floor, gets his 3-point shooting going, that could change a lot in this series, because Miami's determined to pack the paint, and he's had the shoulder issue, that's one, you know.
And
I think that
Grimes leaves less, like Hart was not starting for the Knicks during the season for the most part. And I wonder to some extent if, when we talk about Quickly and why he's not playing as well as we're used to, Josh Hart is a really, like, I remember even back to like his year with that one year that he played with LeBron, Josh Hart consistently had the best net ratings with LeBron on court, just because I feel like he's the sort of player that you plug next to anybody and players improve.
It's baffling how he didn't work out in Portland.
I'm telling you, like, I don't understand that trade. Like, obviously it's easy to say that now, but in the moment, I get that Cam Reddish is flashy. Like, Cam Reddish has really good high water moments. He had a 28, 30-point game in the playoffs in a year where
his highs are
missed,
higher
like,
than
the
Josh
whole season.
Hart. Right.
Yes, but Josh Hart is one of the steadier players in the league.
But he just wasn't shooting in Portland. It was so strange. It was so strange.
Right, but here's my thing, and here's why, even with him not shooting well, I would have, like, to me, you have to be willing to ride out a relatively, and I mean, Josh Hart is not like 22, but what is he, 26, 27?
Right.
You have to be willing to ride out a player that is solid everywhere else except for his shooting. And he, by the way, he's been a good shooter.
Right. History of decent shooting. Yes, like, yes.
Yeah, you've just got to trust that's going to come back around. And then lo and behold, he goes to the Knicks and shoots 55% from three for the rest of the season and has been a dependable player in the playoffs. So I like Josh Hart off the bench for them. I get that you needed to use him for Grimes, and it worked. Mm-hmm. Similar to the conversation we've been having about Steve Kerr and the idea of whether it was Poole for a couple games or now Jermichael Green, that you're going to be inclined to stick with what got you the last few wins, which in that case it was the Cavs series. But I do think that not having Hart come off your bench along with Quickly and having those guys play together as much, I think it does take a little bit of a toll. Like, I don't think you've got as many guys off your bench that are really prepared to score and really prepared to run and transition and open things up for Quickly the way that he was used to. It's not an excuse for him, because I think he still needs to play better whether Hart is out there or not. I've been a little bit stunned at how quiet he's been in this postseason. And to be honest with you, that the Knicks have done this well without Quickly being a good player in the playoffs, because he was such a
massive
part
for
of
them.
What they did. And that was why a big part of why I ultimately voted him as my sixth man of the year, is that I felt like he had a bigger impact on what the Knicks were doing than Malcolm Brogdon did with the Celtics.
Yeah, I mean, the Knicks, they were obviously really good in that Cleveland series, but it's been weird that they're not winning with their offense, which was what they were doing in the regular season. They're at a 109 offensive rating in the playoffs. It's very bad, but their defense has been fantastic, best in the playoffs so far, in large part because of that Cleveland series. So very interesting to see how that plays out moving forward. Are you leaning in a particular direction for game three?
I mean, it's hard not to think that if Butler is anywhere near himself for game three, game four, that things will shift, because, again, the Heat shouldn't have to rely on his own as much. They should not have to rely on Gabe Vincent, Caleb Martin as much, which, again, hats off to them, because they did
they did really good work in that game, and they did enough to theoretically win the game. But Butler should make stuff so much easier for Miami. The Knicks didn't. Go ahead.
No, they would have won until Adam Silver put his hand on Scott Foster's shoulder and said, you know what to do.
You're going to go there. I'm not going to go there. It was a botched call. Like, I'm not denying that. I said it as it was happening.
I'm not interested in talking about the refs. The Heat lost that game. Their offensive rebound or their defensive rebounding loss from that
you
game.
You mentioned, like, the refs twice, and now you're not interested in that.
It's fun to joke about, but, like, the people who get on Twitter are like, I can't believe what I watched. And it's like, come on, dude. Like, there's 100
calls. It was a bad miss call,
though. Yeah, but there's missed calls that we don't even think about because they don't show the replay 20 times that happened in the second quarter. It doesn't matter. It evens out.
I like the Heat, to your question. I do like the Heat. Do you? Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to think that Spo has also done what he's needed to do to keep them competitive in this series. And it's like,
I tend to think
he's been willing to make those changes.
Yeah. I've heard Spo is, like, really locked in. I've heard he's, like, he's on another level in these playoffs is what I've heard. My fear with the Heat is you think at some point the shooting's going to cool off. And I feel like at some point the Knicks offense is going to wake up. I'm just kind of on my toes bracing for that. Like, if Grimes gets it going from three one night, Randall gets it going from three one night, and the Heat, like, start shooting like they shot for the first 84 games of the year, I'm just bracing myself for that a little bit. Before we go,
it's possible.
Yeah, I have one quick question for you. We haven't talked about Nuggets Suns too much. Now Chris Paul is out. If you were Monty, who would you start in Chris Paul's place in game three here? Which I think the Suns are deeply on the ropes in the series without Chris Paul. Because I think I'd start, like, Damian Lee, honestly.
That's what I was about to say, was actually him.
Right?
I mean, you could go a couple different directions with it, I guess. Cameron Payne does not sound like my answer. Would not be my answer. He was rough, and I felt like there's two things. I'm rarely going to criticize Monty Williams. I think he's a fantastic coach. I think he's a great communicator. But I thought that felt like Chris Paul's a point guard. We need a point guard out there since he's not playing. So we're going to put Cameron Payne out there, even though he's been ass, basically.
Well, the problem is, it's like, we were talking about this. Cam Payne played like 3 minutes in that game one, and we were like, whoa, Cam Payne is healthy? Why wasn't he playing?
Right.
So it was kind of like, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
And then he was
at
negative 16 in 16 minutes, if I remember correctly, in game two, and was like one of whatever he was.
Also. Right. They've needed him at times this year.
Shooting.
Yeah.
You just have to have better shooting there. Like, at a certain point, you're not going to win this series anymore because you're defending them better than they can defend you. That's just not going to be the case. Like, I think the Nuggets have shown that they can really defend this team. You're going to have to outscore them, and I don't think Campaign, when he was on a heater and they went to the finals a couple years ago, sure. Campaign right now
doesn't look
that
healthy.
Being the fix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would roll with Damian Lee. I mean, Terrence Ross is a tough scene if that's, like, who you have to start. Yeah. You would be going all in on offense at that point. I just think they need to try something else, someone else.
Right.
You've got guys that are fundamentally, and we talked about this after game one too. There was a sequence where Okogie just didn't shoot from point blank. And it's like, that's a big storyline in the series, is like, you've got to have guys that are willing, ready, able to shoot, even if they miss a few. Maybe Campaign is that guy, but I don't think that's who I would roll with here. I think you need something different. I also think that if we have to be asking these questions, that the Nuggets could sweep the series. It doesn't mean they will, but they could. And at this point, it feels more likely than the idea of the Suns mounting a comeback long enough for Chris Paul to be able to get back into the series meaningfully.
The Suns are in dire straits. I'd start Damian Lee. Let Okogie or him bring the ball up if you don't want to tax Book like that. I would not be surprised if Book plays all 48 in game three. I would only play Campaign against the Nuggets bench. And you got to work in some level of Terrence Ross and TJ Warren.
I really hate that Chris Paul's not healthy. Denver might have
Chris Paul was
won this in a gentleman's sweep anyway.
When he got hurt, he started to wake up. So, yeah. I liked Denver in this series, no matter what, but I'm with you. It's sad.
Yes, and I think a lot of people did. Like I thought Phoenix had a pretty good shot, which I even saw after game one. I was like, okay, got to rethink that one. Maybe they didn't. You and Pino were in my text saying, like, I don't know if like they're up for that challenge between Booker and KD defensively. We saw right away in game one that Booker was kind of all over the place defensively. No, I won't say all over the place, but not in good enough position a lot of the time to take things away.
You know, because that's the thing with Book will compete
to win a game with those two.
Yeah, Book will compete against anyone individually defensively. Like, it's not like he's getting, like, he will compete. He'll be physical.
Yes,
it's all those little things that you need to do off the ball, especially against a team like Denver that I understand from his perspective. If he's playing 45 minutes, he's got to pick his spots defensively. And that's the position.
And you're also not going to be like, you're going to be tired and you're going to make mistakes because you're tired too. Like, there's a lot that goes into it, but it's just, I think ultimately, even after one game and then particularly after two games where Chris Paul's not there either or won't be there, they already had too short of a rotation to go up against a team that knows exactly who they are, knows exactly how they want to attack you. If you decide, okay, we're just going to let Jokic get whatever he wants and we're going to take everybody else away, Jokic could take advantage of that. If you decide to take Jokic away, then everybody else gets going. It's like what I've been really struck by in this playoffs is how similar some of the series have been. Like, we've seen this now with the Lakers and the Warriors as far as the way the Lakers wanted to defend Steph. We've seen it from the standpoint of them trying to force the ball out of Randle's hands and then some of the Knicks players being able to get going. It's risky, and it's only riskier when you've got a smaller rotation than your opponent has, because you don't have as many fixes. You don't have the JaMychal Green fix that the Warriors do, because you don't have as many guys that you trust. And even if you do, when they are in minus 16 and 16 minutes and not shooting and only played 3 minutes in your first game.
We'll see.
I would love to see them.
You are sick of campaign, dude. You are. You're just lighting into the.
I'm not campaigning for campaign.
You are. Every chance you get, you're like, this man was a minus 16 in 16 minutes. So you're just.
Champagne for my real friends. Real pain for my sham friends.
On that note.
I just had to say that. That's a Spike Lee movie, by the way, that comes from, I think. 25th Hour.
Still waiting for you to introduce me to Spike, but we'll save that for another episode. Chris, that will do it for today, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. People have hit us up. Please, you're welcome to continue to email us at the Open Floor account. We're seeing your emails. We'll try to work them in, I promise. So feel free to keep your emails coming, openfloormail@gmail.com. Until the next episode, everyone, please continue to enjoy the NBA playoffs. We'll be right back.